Well, since you're all getting so quiet and attentive, I think we'll go ahead and get started and give Commissioner Fritz a chance to catch up with us. I want to welcome everyone to this work session on street fee proposal, and want to walk through a number of issues with the council this afternoon and get some reactions, guidance for staff and for our committee. Carla, do you want to call the roll? And then she stepped out. We'll call the roll later. So want to welcome everyone and cue this up. We've got a series of issues where we want to try to get council feedback and discussion with our director and staff. I'll run through those briefly. Just want to first thank the committees, and we'll be hearing a little bit from them today. Really, because of their work, we've really made a lot of progress here, and I think they really helped Port Wendise the proposals that might be before us here shortly. The committees have more or less created the framework for a new ordinance with a number of points left for us to resolve, and that's the discussion that we need to have now leading up to formal council discussion of a potential ordinance or ordinances. My hope is that staff, Josh Alpert, my office, and others can continue to work on a proposal that takes the committee's work and council feedback and have something for us to deliberate on within a week or two. So the issues that we really need to discuss, hi, Commissioner Fritz, that we need to discuss and provide some feedback on are, first of all, on the mechanism itself. Do we have it right in terms of what's coming from the committees in terms of a new mechanism for business and a new methodology for residential fees? Do we have it right in terms of a project, set of project lists and a balance between maintenance and safety? In fact, we need to peg that balance between maintenance and safety. There are options about sunset and referral, options about nonprofit discounts, questions about the city's contribution to the costs of the system, and then the question about do we need a charter amendment to dedicate the uses of the revenues involved. So I'll go into more detail about those as we proceed, but I want to first call on Leah Treat to come up and talk about the work from her standpoint and the state of the system and the state of the maintenance and safety discussion that has emerged from their analysis of the system. So, Leah, come on up, please. Steve, anything you want to add before we start? I'm sorry.
So, good afternoon. This is my first council work session. So, thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, Commissioner Fish, Mayor Hales, Commissioner Fritz, and Commissioner Novick. It's a pleasure to be here before you today, and I really appreciate you making the time for today's special session on the Our Streets Transportation Funding Proposal. Since we last met on this important initiative, we formed additional work groups focused on improving the funding mechanism. That work resulted in a more progressive proposal for raising revenues and a clearer and more strategic plan for spending the revenues. I'm going to keep my opening remarks short, and I'm going to focus them on three important takeaways from the past several months of work. First, working with a diverse group of Portlanders, often with divergent interests, has resulted in a better proposal for raising additional revenue for our transportation network. As a participant in each of these working groups, I was encouraged to see a growing consensus as we discussed significant changes to the original proposal. Over the course of several months, we tackled many difficult issues, and through those conversations, we began to generate more and more support for the recommendations before you today. I've heard from many people over the last 5 months that they understand PBOT has very little discretionary revenue, and our Bureau truly needs additional resources to properly care for our transportation network. Two, working together has resulted in a spending plan that is evidence-based, equitable, and ensures a high return on investment. Our partners in the business community have stressed the importance of ensuring that our expenditures are guided by the return on investment. Our planned maintenance expenditures are a good example of how this principle has guided our work. The proposed paving list focuses resources on the most cost-effective treatments that extend the useful life of our roadways before allowing them to deteriorate to the point that will require costly rebuilds. Our partners in the safety and health communities have stressed the importance of ensuring that our expenditures on safety are driven by an evidence-based understanding of need and treatment. Investments in safer sidewalks and crossing improvements in East Portland are driven by the fact that demographic data indicates that Portlanders in East Portland are 2.3 times as likely to die as a pedestrian, and that adding a rapid flash beacon to an unsignalized intersection on a busy street reduces crashes by more than 40%. Our proposed project list addresses some of these issues and recognizes other neighborhoods are in need of similar treatments as well. The project list focuses on crossing improvements, high crash corridors, and sidewalks. Our partners in the freight community have been leaders in highlighting the impacts of congestion caused by crashes. And in addition, we are increasingly hearing concerns from businesses that identify the cost of crashes in terms of work loss and medical costs. The Centers for Disease Control has estimated the cost of crashes in Portland alone to be over $100 million annually. Third and last, over the last few months, I have occasionally heard concern that the amount of revenue is not going to make a significant difference. I want to assure you that the projects and services identified in this proposal will address critical maintenance and safety needs. With this funding, we will more than double the investment in our existing paving program. We estimate with the additional resources in preventive maintenance, we will avoid $50 million a year in future costs. Repaving and sealing is good for our roads and good for our taxpayers. It is also an excellent example of maintenance works that improves the road conditions for all users. And with this funding, we'll be able to build safer streets and crosswalks. Most serious injuries and crashes take place on busy streets, often over and over again at the same location. This funding proposal will build safety improvements on those high crash corridors. We will better separate cars from freight, from pedestrians and bikes, and ensure that seniors can get to transit, kids can get to school, and freight can efficiently reach its destination. So in closing, I would like to reiterate that the proposal you are considering today and working on has been refined to be more progressive and equitable. The projects will provide a significant return on investment and make critical safety improvements. And while our overall needs are greater than what this proposal will generate, the revenue will make a worthwhile difference in the overall needs. Thank you.
Questions for Leah at this juncture? So, I'm going to call Ruth to come up and summarize the work of the committees.
Okay.
So, good afternoon. Commissioners, Ruth Adkins, Oregon Opportunity Network. Really pleased to be here today. Fred Miller wasn't able to be here, so I will do my best to represent. Just to briefly recap, as you know, there were three advisory work groups. There was the original needs and funding committee led by Fred Miller, which was formed back in January, to advise you on the transportation funding effort. And then one of the two new groups that was convened this July was the business work group, which was charged with refining the non-residential portion of the fee to minimize negative impacts to the business community. And this group was also led by Fred. And then there was the nonprofit low-income group, which I chaired. And our charge was to advise on discounts to avoid negative impacts for low-income residents, refining the business fee to minimize negative impacts to nonprofits and public institutions, as well as to advise on how discounts for existing water and sewer ratepayers could be more easily accessed by low-income Portlanders. So just a side note that we did not complete our work on this last piece of our charge, and we hope to do so, so you'll be hearing from us later this week with a request to continue our work around the water sewer discount issue. So altogether, the advisory groups had a broad and diverse membership. I believe there were 66 people on the different committees representing 61 organizations, businesses, and groups. On behalf of Fred and myself, just want to offer huge thanks to all the folks who served on these committees. We really dug into the pretty complex issues, went to a bunch of meetings, thought about things in between, and really worked hard on finding common ground and landing on some solutions that were workable and fair. So I think you've received the report from Fred and myself that summarizes the advice and recommendations from the work groups. And while there are still a few areas where we did not land in consensus, and I look forward to your discussion in determining the best course of action for these, we really did find agreement on some important key values and landed a strong proposal for your consideration. Huge thank you to Mayor Hales and Commissioner Novick for taking the time to step back and gather this additional input from us in the community. Certainly no public process is ever perfect, but I think I certainly feel really good about the quality of work that stakeholders and staff did together and that we did, as others have said, end up with a better proposal as a result. Also want to thank Fred Miller for his steady leadership and focus on identifying those areas of common ground and really moving us forward in a positive manner throughout the process so we could get to this day and to your deliberation. And I really want to thank the city staff who just provided outstanding and expert support throughout the process. Most of us were completely new to the world of the PBOT budget, and given the complexities, we had a ton of questions, lots of data requests, providing additional scenarios and so forth. There was a huge amount of work for staff, but from start to finish, they were professional and patient and just did a terrific job supporting us. So really want to send our kudos to the staff. And finally, thanks to all of you for your leadership. I'm really excited to see the proposal move forward and for the opportunity to begin to address the urgent safety and maintenance needs on our streets. So with that, unless there's any questions, I'm turn it over to staff for lots more detail and look forward to your discussion.
You and the other citizens that stepped up to work on these committees, you really have put in a lot of time and a great deal of detail and fleshed this out.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Lots of paper, so.
A lot.
But, yeah, but
Thank you.
There were awesome cookies. You know, we had a good time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's always good.
Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Can you just elaborate a bit on what some of the issues, you know, the unresolved issues still are? Oh, sorry.
Forget about that. Can you just elaborate a bit on some of the areas of disagreement between the committees on safety maintenance split and level of progressivity or regressivity?
Yeah, different perspectives. And we did attend some of each other's meetings, and to the degree that we could, had joint discussions as much as we could, but we also needed to keep moving forward with our unique charges. I guess I would say on the maintenance and safety split, the nonprofit low-income group really supported more of the 50-50 or balanced approach. I think what we heard from the business group was wanting to be a little more toward the maintenance side. That was one area. On the nonprofit discount, where we landed, and we went through quite a discussion on this, but finally landed that the most clean and easy to administer for the nonprofit discount would be a 50% across the board without trying to distinguish between different sizes and types of nonprofits. I think on the business group, I believe they proposed a sliding scale for different sizes, ranging from 40% for the smallest nonprofits, 10% for the largest. We all agreed around a progressive exemption for low-income folks, so that was a huge area of common agreement. I think one of the big issues still to resolve is around where the cap should be at the higher end.
And that also translates into what people pay at the lower end, right?
Well, except for the exemption, I think.
Right.
Right.
Right. But like at the
sort of more moderate
$50,000 income level,
right?
Under the version with a cap of $20 for higher income, they're paying $12 a month, whereas at the $50,000 level, when some people are paying $200 a month, the people making $50,000 are paying $4 a month, as I recall.
Right. Right. I mean, really, the focus, just speaking for our group, our focus is really on the lowest income folks and making sure that the most vulnerable Portlanders were not negatively impacted by this. So that's where we came out, and we were really pleased to see the exemption at the lowest ends. But yes, it's for you all to resolve where you land in terms of the moderate and upper income levels. And I think one other piece was around, and I'm sure I'm forgetting stuff, but staff can fill in, around the sunset. The nonprofit low-income group felt that we all agree there needed to be strong oversight, for sure, throughout this, with an equity lens on how the money is being spent. But I think the nonprofit low-income group felt that having that oversight committee suggest to council whether or not it needed to be referred versus having an automatic, it will be referred after X number of years from implementation. So that was another area. And I'm probably forgetting something else.
Where there was a difference between the two committees.
Right. I mean, but I think as Leah summarized really well, I mean, we did, and thanks again to Fred's leadership, really landed on clarity around the need and the importance and that we, the urgency, and that we needed additional revenue that wasn't already in the PBOT budget.
Are there questions for Ruth?
Mayor, I'd just be interested, since Ruth mentioned the equity lens, I'd be interested if you want to just say anything more about that. Something that in all the infrastructure bureaus we struggle with, because however you peg an equity lens, there's also the reality that certain pipes and infrastructure is going to fail, and you have to calculate the impact on the total system of a failure, even if it's located in an area that's already overserved rather than underserved. Any thoughts just generally about the equity lens?
Yeah, thanks so much. I mean, We really appreciated the mapping that staff provided that showed the distribution of where the safety and maintenance work would be done. And we felt it was really important that there be tracking and transparency for where the work was, so that folks know where it would happen. And just the recognition, as Leah mentioned, that folks living in poverty, communities of color, are far more likely to be impacted, particularly by the safety issues. So it was a very high value for the nonprofit low-income group as advocates to make sure that that remained both, you know, part of the implementation of the proposal as well as the ongoing oversight and accountability. Knowing that and recognizing that Leah and her staff are going to need to juggle all kinds of challenges going forward, the project list is not going to be set in stone. And what I heard from our group was wanting to give staff that flexibility while also having the oversight as we go. So there's no easy, you know, we definitely wanted staff to exercise their professional judgment and respond as they needed to as a situation emerged, knowing there's a huge need.
So I guess I just have a general question at this point, and that is, did the committee look at, or if not the committee, I guess I'll ask the director of the Bureau, issues around what if the money generated isn't sufficient due to cost, whether it's government cost if it's the public sector carrying it out, or whether it's contracted work in the private sector over budget? Any kind of sensitivity analysis done around that? And I guess if the answer is no, I guess I'd like to ask for some estimates. You have a list now, a detailed list of projects. I'd like to have a category added there, which projects would be done by city employees versus which would be contracted out, and I understand there's a state law that speaks fairly specifically to those parameters, so I guess I'd like to see that. But then, yeah, the broader question, any sensitivity analysis to, you know, what if the $40 million a year doesn't, for whatever reason, doesn't get through the project list? What's the feedback loop that benefits those who are paying into the system from that kind of a overrun scenario? And was that something the committee talked about, Ruth? Or?
I think I would defer to Leah on this. We didn't get down, I don't recall, into that level of detail.
So we did, one, we will get you the list broken down by contractor and what would be done by in-house. We know that based on the estimated cost. We did do a life cycle analysis based on the amount of revenue that we are projected to collect based on $40 million annually, and a split that the assumption we made of the split is 47% going to safety and 53% going to maintenance. And with that assumption, picked the streets that were in good condition, about to tip into fair to do preventative maintenance, and then some further level of analysis about some rehab as well, so we could do some work there. And we have projected that we will defer $50 million annually in costs. So we have an in-house system where we track how much it costs for our crews to do work, and we can project that annually. We use that in doing our projections. For the contract out work, we've used past estimates to make the projections. So I would say that one of the critical components that you all will be discussing today that can also help answer this question is the role of the Oversight Committee in how the funds are managed and allocated and tracking the expenditures.
So Lee, in terms of cost estimates for specific projects, we're basing it on our prior experience with similar projects.
That's accurate. Thank you.
Well, my understanding is that you haven't spent it all. You haven't identified all 6 years worth of projects. You've identified the first batch, and then you're going to have some community input into the next batch.
My understanding was that we had the six-year list. Yeah, please come on up. We have so for the maintenance, we have the first 3 years, and then for the safety, I thought we had the first 3 years plus recommended second 3 years.
Right. Actually, Commissioner, if I may interject, we stole shamelessly from your process in parks, where we identified the first three years, which we think is pretty solid. For the next 3 years, we have a longer list of safety projects than actually we could afford. And with the assumption that we'll wind up picking and choosing between those as to what actually gets funded. Am I right, Mark?
Yes, Mark Clear. Portland Bureau of Transportation. That's right. We have programmed the first 3 years and recommendations in the last 3 years, very similar to parks. We're also using, with our safety projects, our normal contingency estimates so that we have some cushion to deal with project costs that fluctuate. And it is, I think, a good opportunity going between the first 3 years and the second 3 years of the program to balance out where we may have missed some of those targets.
Right. And it's also an opportunity for the public to weigh in. You know, there's a lot longer list than we have money for in both the parks bond and in transportation. So you, like we in parks, decided in May to start identifying the first list, which are the worst of the worst. And then I appreciate the opportunity for the public to then weigh in, because there are choices to be made, and that there needs to be that opportunity, which then allows for the correction that Commissioner Saltzman is concerned about as far as the cost estimates turning out to be, I would guess, higher than predicted, partly because the economy's recovered. We're seeing a lot of contracts coming in at higher than we had previously been getting, and also because some of these estimates are really old estimates, because we haven't had the money, so why would you put the time into doing the estimates? So I appreciate you borrowing that approach. You're welcome to it.
So if there are no other questions at this point for Ruth, then we might want to move on to Mark and Jamie Waltz, summarizing what further we've heard from the public in the intervening weeks, and flesh that out a bit more for us, please.
Mayor, Commissioners, I'm going to have you start digging into your packets now. One of the pieces in your packet is a list of letters and emails that we've received from 26 of our work group members, organizations, and individuals who are providing feedback based on the report from Ruth and Fred. So there's a cover memo, and it's a thick packet with a bunch of letters. And so I'm not going to go into detail, but Ruth did summarize the areas of support and some of the areas of difference. The other thing that I'm going to have you dig into is I'm going to talk a little bit about the changes in the funding mechanisms that you're considering today. What we brought to you in May as the proposal for identifying $53 million worth of revenue has considerably changed to what's in front of you today that you'll be considering. Through the public feedback that we received in May and then in two town halls we had in June, we heard quite a few concerns about the transportation user fee mechanisms. On the business side, we had heard concerns from building managers and property owners that they were concerned that because we're using the water meters as the platform for collecting the transportation user fee, that was going to put these landlords and property owners in the position of becoming tax collectors and figuring out how to allocate this fee across their tenants. Some of the other concerns we heard were that the ITE trip generation manual was not an accurate representation of the actual number of trips that businesses in Portland we're generating, and especially for small businesses with few number of employees or low revenue, that was not an accurate target, they felt. There was also feeling that the monthly rates were too high for businesses and that there were changes that were needed. So what we, through the deliberation with our working groups, we have the business entity flat fee. And I'm going to direct you, mine's a little marked up for my notes, but it's a sheet that has columns A through D with an external. And this is the business entity flat fee is how we propose collecting the business portion of the fee. And again, we're still looking at a 50-50 split, half of the revenue being collected from the residential side, half being collected from the business and non-residential side. So I'm going to walk you through an example to show you how this works. And this monthly fee for the business is still based on number or based on trips and usage of the system. It takes into account three factors. The type of, well, actually four, the type of business you are, the square footage of your business, the number of employees, which are tied to that trip generation that we were using previously, and then the gross annual gross revenue of your business. So
when did you choose gross revenue rather than net revenue?
I think that was something that we had easily available through the business license tax because we are using the business license tax platform. One of the changes that we moved away from using the water and sewer billing platform to the business license tax. And so one of the reasons why the monthly fee has decreased so much is we're going from 11,000 business accounts to 120,000 accounts through the business license tax. So we're charging more business entities so we could decrease the monthly fees.
But Jamie, it's my recollection that there was some discussion of using a profits-based model, and there was more support in the business work group to go into this combination of employees and square footage and gross revenue. But there was a discussion of basing it on profits instead, as I recall.
Yeah, and
that's a big change that she touched on there that we ought to make sure everybody understands. And I think I got this example right, but under the original proposal, if the PacWest building across the street had a single water meter, we would have sent a bill based on trip generation to that single taxpayer. Now we will bill each business that's a tenant in that building based on their employees, their square footage, and their gross income.
That's why there's so many more taxpayers.
You gotta love this system. Yeah, that's why there's so many more taxpayers than there were in the original proposal in terms of the number of business entities that are paying the tax.
And under the previous proposal, the average business was paying $76 per month, and now the monthly equivalent ranges from $2.50 on the low end to $140 on the high end, whereas under the May proposal, the high end for an individual business was about $3,300 per month. So we've been able to really decrease it. So one of the other things that we've done is we used to have 100 different business groups, and we've collapsed that to 15. So it's administratively easier. It also makes it easier for a business to figure out what category. So let's pretend that we're a restaurant, and if you're looking at the sheet, that would put you under group 4. And let's say we're a restaurant with 1,500 square feet. We have 5 employees, and we gross $500,000 in revenue per year. So you have to meet 2 of the 3 criteria in order to fit into categories A through D. So based on a 1,500 square foot facility with 5 employees, $500,000 gross revenue, I would meet 2 of the 3 categories, and that would put me in category A. So as a restaurant, I'd pay $12.50 a month. We do have a category on the far right called external, and this allows us to capture revenue from business entities that don't have a physical footprint or headquarter in the city of Portland, but they do work within the city, like maybe a plumber that has a headquarters in Beaverton, and they have people come respond to businesses or homes that need plumbing issues. They are still paying a business license tax, and through this, we're able to capture the revenue from those businesses.
Why are lodging and medical in their own category? And why are they the highest?
I'm going to have to turn to our expert, Gary Corbin, to answer why lodging and medical are in their own category.
Austin with Innovative Growth Solutions. So the rates that were developed on the table that you see were originally developed based on rates from the May proposal, based on trips. Those, however, would have generated something like $150 million or something to that level. So they were then scaled down and then rounded to the nearest $5, I think. Lodging and medical generate a lot of trips per average, you know, size of the business. And so they would have had the highest fees. And so their fees float to the top in this structure as well.
Why medical? It doesn't seem to me like it would have this.
The way that it's built is each category has sort of small, medium, and large, or eight, or actually four different size categories. The medical category tend to be larger businesses as well in terms of square footage.
But the way you have it is that a small medical facility is paying more tax than a restaurant, than a small restaurant, and it seems to me that if you're a single practitioner dentist, you're probably going to have one patient per billable hour or two, whereas a restaurant of the same size is going to have more people.
True, but a small medical facility is much larger than a small restaurant. And so even though they're both considered small for their category, within their category of medical, they tend to have a larger footprint and larger trip generation. And again, trip generation was just one piece of this to get it started. The other factors were taken into account as well.
I have two questions. I wrote down when you were giving us this summary, I think you said the range was 250 to 140. My chart seems to top out at 120. Am I misreading it?
I think that I might have been referring to a different version.
The
version
in your packet is 120. Yeah, 120
is the highest. 120.
There are some different variations. One of the differences that we have now is we are proposing a nonprofit discount, which we didn't do over the last one. And so the business working group and the nonprofit working group helped us determine the categories for number of employees, annual gross revenue, cutoffs, and so under some of the different proposals, 140 had been the top. So you're correct, 120 on this one.
And my second question is, sometimes at the abstract level, it's hard to put the human face on it. So could you give us just a couple more examples? And let's say that we're in the Montevilla neighborhood, and we want to either go to Bipartisan Cafe or we're going to go to the hardware store around the corner. If you applied these charts just roughly, just conceptually, what are we looking at for some of our neighborhood businesses, a retail and a restaurant?
Okay, so if you're a small restaurant, let's say you have 5,000 square feet, you have 10 employees, and $1 million of annual revenue, that would probably, I think if I'm doing this right, you would be in category B, which would be $25 a month. In the other example, the hardware store. Sure. Just flat out, almost all of the businesses fall into columns A or B in the city of Portland. It's a preponderance of somewhere in the neighborhood of about 80%. So just, and if you're just going to place a bet without knowing anything, they'd be in either column A or B.
So just by way of context, my recollection is in our 50 neighborhood business districts, 97% of the businesses have five or fewer employees. And so that's why you're suggesting that it would be either A or B, and then we just look at the fit the grid.
That's right, yeah.
And is it your intent to, it's five employees even if they work an hour a week, or is it five FTE?
FTE.
Just
Following up on Commissioner Fritz's question about the different groups, is it fair to say that there's the business groups represented in the work group represented businesses in each of these categories, and are we confident that they have reached out to businesses in each of these categories to get their feedback?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say that. We had Venture Portland and Small Business Advisory Committee represented, as well as some large groups, PBA. We had OHSU. We had PPS. All of those were involved, as well as large corporations like Standard Insurance.
And how does it work again? Is the ruling factor the number of employees or the gross revenue?
It's 2 out of 3. So if you qualify in either the revenue, employees, or square footage for a given category, you're in that category. And if you don't, if you're spread across all of them, then it's column C. And that's because column C was kind of the middle-sized business. In the case of each of these categories, if you average the square footage and revenue and things like that, and that becomes the average because the high-end ones tend to draw up the mean.
So Montebello Lumber, same neighborhood, if they had more than 21 employees, which I'm not sure that they would, and if they grossed more than $2.5 million, would move up to that next category. But there's definitely more than 5,000 square feet. They're 10 or 15, so
right.
The threshold's 15,000 square feet. Whereas
right.
Yahala and Bipartisan Cafe and Union Rose and the other storefronts right there would all be in that smallest retail category because of their size and their number of employees, even if their revenue was higher.
Right.
Okay, and I just want to switch then to the residential portion of the fee. There's a worksheet in your packet. One of the biggest pieces of feedback that we received from the May proposal is that there were a lot of concerns about the regressivity of the fee and the impact to low-income individuals. The other issue was being able to provide a discount to low-income individuals living in multifamily housing, since most multifamily housing units had one water meter. Again, that presented a challenge of how to distribute that fee to all of the tenants in that building. So with the new proposal, we have moved towards using the arts tax as a platform, and it's an income tax-based bracketed flat capped fee, which is quite a mouthful to say. But you have a worksheet here, and the idea is basically looking at your adjusted gross income. It should be right at here. Yeah, thank you. All of the work groups agreed that the lowest income individuals should not be paying the fee. And so the agreement was that for a joint filers making $30,000 in adjusted gross income or less a year should be exempt, and single filers making $25,000 or less per year should be exempt. And the other...
So before you move on, why $30,000 for two versus $25,000 for one?
$30,000 was equivalent to about 50% of the median family income, and that was where they felt people were starting living in poverty and really would be adversely impacted. And then we had looked at doing $15,000 for a joint filer, but they also felt that an individual, the nonprofit work group, felt that the individuals living at $25,000 as single filers were also really at that threshold where 30,000 joint. So it was a decision that came out of the working groups.
So we've got feedback from Joe Vanderveer, the Commission on Disability, saying that he would be supportive of 25,000 for individuals, but he was saying that 30,000 for couples is too low.
Okay.
And it does seem like there's a marriage penalty there.
Okay.
Sort of a partnership penalty.
So it's based on your adjusted gross income. So an example, the top row on your sheet here is based on single filers, and then the bottom one is based on joint filing. So if you're, let's say, an example of an you make $83,000 in adjusted gross income as a joint filer. And there's a couple different cap options. So the other concern was how high do the highest income earners pay under this proposal. And there's three different proposals for you to consider today, a $20 cap, $100 cap, or a $200 cap. And so under the three different scenarios, if you're making $83,000 adjusted gross income as a joint filer, under the $20 cap option, you'd be paying $12 a month. Under the $100 cap option, you'd be paying $8 a month. And under the $200 cap option, you'd also be paying $8 a month. So this version is a lot simpler to be able to figure out where you would be fitting in with your monthly fee.
By the way, I misspoke earlier. I said that under the $20 cap version, people making $50,000 would be paying, under the $20 cap version, people making $50,000 would be paying $12 a month. Actually, people making exactly $50,000 would be paying $6 a month, but people making between $50,000 and $75,000 would be paying $12 a month, whereas under the $200 cap version at the top, people making $50,000 to $75,000 would be paying $4 a month.
And actually, they'd be paying, this is an annual rate, because there isn't currently going to be a monthly option.
These are monthly equivalents, and the right now we would be piggybacking on the arts tax platform, so it is an annual fee.
Although we are going to try to make options available for people to go online and pay in increments, and I think Terry Williams is going to be speaking to that.
And since we're also trying to encourage people to pay their combined water sewer bill monthly, that would be good messaging. Can I just inquire, under the joint filer options 2 and 3, you double the cap in option 3, but the impact on people making 50 to 100 stays the same. I'm just curious why that is.
It's just the way that we broke down the different brackets, and this is something that we can still play with. It's not set in stone, but looking at making sure that the kind of middle income earners weren't paying too much. But you're right, that's one of the reasons why I use that example, is that the bracket shift a little bit, but they're still paying the same monthly equivalent.
Commissioner Fish, you're exactly right that this is an area where we can look at different sets of numbers. And speaking for myself, and I think I'd also speak for my wife, since we would fall into the 175 to 250 category, so under the $100 cap, we would pay $32 a month. We'd be equally willing to pay $32 a month as opposed to $25 under a $200 overall cap.
I guess I'm confused. Are we talking about caps that are annual or monthly? So $200 per month per individual is the top you could pay.
In that version,
right. So, Jamie, a second ago, you were talking about something being $8 a month. Where is that?
Just an example, if you're making $83,000 a year, you look at where you fall within the brackets. And so if I were making $83,000 adjusted gross income under option 2, I'd fall in the bracket that's greater than $75,000 to $100,000. So I make... It's $8 a month, which is, we're talking monthly equivalents here. And then under option 3 with the $200 cap, again, I fall within that same bracket of $75,000 to $100,000, and that under this scenario is $8 as well.
Other questions?
Just one other. You go from $20 to $100 to $200. Were there other intermediate numbers you looked at, or why did you peg those three caps?
Well, we had originally, when we were putting different scenarios to the work groups, the original was a $20 cap. The nonprofit low-income work groups came back really wanting to stress the progressivity of the fee, that the higher incomes pay more. So these were different scenarios that they suggested we look into.
One thing worth mentioning at some point is we did get this letter from a number of different groups, AARP, BTA, OPAL, Elders in Action, Oregon Opportunity Network, Oregon Environmental Council, the Food Bank, and they recommended going with the option where the people who make over $500,000 are paying $200 a month in order to lower the impact, not just on the lowest income people, but the people in the middle.
No Okay. If there aren't any more questions on methodology and public feedback, I think we should turn to project lists and how those were developed and what's in front of us there in terms of how the funds would be spent.
Great. So if you pull out your R Streets project list breakout by years, this one big spreadsheet with the pie charts on the bottom, I'll use this to give you a quick overview of the process we use to pick the projects, as well as the some of the specific projects that are on the list. So on that first page, you'll see at the top that there's a estimated six-year net revenue, $173.8 million, that we've broken out into two buckets. That 1 to 3 years of revenue that we're talking about, a specific list of projects that we're recommending that we implement in the first 3 years, as well as some out-year recommendations, which we obviously want to use our transportation system plan that's going to be developed over the next year and other good community work to refine those projects. You'll see in that first clustering of project work, we've identified the maintenance projects. Obviously, there's a huge overlap. Some of these have very quite a bit of safety elements to them. But we've identified the 53% of revenue that would be allocated toward maintenance projects. By far, the largest allocation toward one focused area of work in this whole proposal is to paving streets, focused mostly on 80% of that revenue on paving a busy street. So you can see right there, that's 34% of the total allocation for paving busy streets and 8% of the total allocation for paving local streets, or 42% of that total. In addition to that, we have some additional revenue allocated for signals, street lights, and signs on our busiest streets where crashes tend to be clustered, as well as some of that work on residential streets and some bridge work as well. The next category of work that you'll see is the 47% of revenue that we've proposed to allocate to safety projects.
Actually, Mark, may I interject for a moment?
Yes.
There's obviously the maintenance list would be a long list, but I asked for just a few examples of busy streets that would receive preventive maintenance, 2-inch grind and pave. In the maintenance side, they would include, for example, Northeast Halsey between 126th to 148th, East Burnside between 47th and 59th, Holgate between 42nd and 56th. So it's just a smattering of examples.
Thanks, Commissioner. And there's a map included in your packet. You don't need to look at it right now. It's also the one that's right over here that highlights all those maintenance projects. They're broken out between the preventive maintenance and the major rehab. Transitioning down to the 47% that we're currently proposing to allocate toward safety projects, you can see at the top of that list, the priorities are adding sidewalks, 11% of the total budget for sidewalks, about 9.4% for high crash corridors, 6.8% for crossing improvements. There's just more and more data out there that shows that pedestrians are really at the most risk in crossing some of our busy streets, especially at unsignalized intersections. So we're putting quite a bit of resources against that, as well as minimizing those conflicts between users on our busiest streets with bike lanes. And then you can see the biggest investment on the residential street side is our Safe Routes to School program. Portland now has more schools participating in our Safe Routes to School program than any other city in the country. And we just have these long lists of projects that have been generated by the schools that aren't funded. In addition to that, there's some work for neighborhood greenways on residential streets and then alternative street design as well. So if you flip to the page 4 of this document, I'm going to jump to some of the additional safety elements. You'd see the high crash corridor program. And when you look at this, you'll see here that we summarize what the program is, the criteria for project selection, and then we have examples of projects that are the projects that we propose to fund in the first 3 years, as well as some recommendations in year 4 through 6. What we've tried to do here is to make sure that we're able to move forward with what staff and our advisory committees see as being the highest priority projects in each of those corridors, as well as some very important projects like that first one on the list, 122nd Avenue. Improvements that actually will result in a number of advantages for transit and safety in the neighborhood.
Mark, if I may just highlight that for a moment. We've been having conversations with TriMet for well over 2 years about the fact that a lot of people in East Portland feel that having frequent bus service on 122nd is absolutely essential. So I asked Neil McFarland a couple of years ago, what would it take for that to happen? And some months ago, he and Alan Leto and his staff said, you know what? We think that we can justify adding frequent service ourselves if you, the city, make some safety improvements, fill in some gaps on the sidewalks, make some crossing improvements that would improve access to 122nd. And we said, okay, what are those improvements? And they finally sent us a list, which to my relief was, quote, only, end quote, $8 million long. And so what they're saying is, if we make $8 million of safety improvements along 122nd, they are confident that they can provide frequent service on that street. So that's something I'm extremely excited about.
The other one that's probably worth noting on that list is the $2 million for ODOT partnership. Council's been having a number of conversations with ODOT to try to see how we can get more investment on important streets like Barber and 82nd and Powell. This money would give us some money to continue to leverage those investments and potentially provide match on some of those key projects as they're identified.
Although I have to say, not nearly as much as we'd like to have. I mean, doing the outer Powell conceptual design plan as outlined by the community would cost about $60 million. And it would be nice to be able to go to ODOT and say, we'll give you 20 if you come up with 40. It's harder if we say, we can give you 2 if you can come up with 58. But it would be nice to have something to start with.
So transitioning to page 5, crossing improvements. To me, I'm as a old traffic safety guy, I'm really impressed with this list of projects that we have put together. And in the area of crossing improvements, 7 years ago when we did Safe, Sound, and Green, we were still in a position where we had unsignalized crossings and there wasn't clear direction of even what to do. Now we know that adding rapid flash beacons at those locations, like we've done in a number of locations across the city, dramatically improves not only safety but compliance for people that are trying to cross the street. And so we've gone through with our East Portland in Motion plan and with other work across the city, working aggressively with TriMet to identify some of those key crossing improvements and projects that help with that. And this is that prioritized list. I think it also includes some things as we think about the out years, which are really going to help us with this work. So, for example, we don't currently have something like East Portland in Motion in Southwest. We have federal funding for a Southwest in Motion project. And you can see on this list, we've identified future crossing improvements identified. So that Southwest in Motion as another way of making sure that we pick the right projects as we move forward. So if you transition to page 6, this is where we're highlighting the sidewalk work. Again, as Commissioner Novick was just mentioning, there's a lot of sidewalk work in High Crash Corridor as a part of that 122nd improvement, and there's still some sidewalk work in our Safe Routes to School projects as well. But in this one category of sidewalk expenditures, right now we're really focusing on two parts of town. East Portland, the projects that have been identified in the East Portland in Motion project, as well as Southwest Portland's highest priority project next to getting sidewalks on Barber, a state facility, but completing the sidewalks between Multnomah Village and West Portland. We've included $5 million on this list. There's another $5 million of SDC funds, and there's some additional work that we're looking forward to doing in order to bring down the cost of this project that would include rescoping the project, probably to sidewalks on one side of the street, and some additional work to figure out how we can continue to keep the overall cost, including stormwater, down on the project as well. The next group of projects that we've identified are protected bike lanes and routes. And this has been, I think, a really good conversation. We had a good meeting this morning of our different advisory committees where we talked more about this. The first project you see on the list is a project to fill out the protected bike lane network in the central city. The Portland Business Alliance has done a good job of letting the city know that from their perspective, it would be much easier for us to implement some of our bicycle safety projects in the downtown if we had a better plan of what specific streets were the highest priorities and how we were going to make that work for all modes. So we have a grant to do that, but we're pretty certain that there's going to be additional costs associated with really implementing that plan. So we want some additional resources for that. In addition, there's a opportunity to leverage some SDC funds on the Flanders project, which takes some of the pressure off of some of that traffic that currently find itself on other busy streets in that area, as well as to be supportive of work in what currently is our highest crash corridor for bikes, Northeast and North Broadway on the east side.
Can you tell me how the Flanders project got on there?
Yeah, one of the things that we did in this effort was to look at all the SDC projects that are currently on the list that aren't moving forward because of a lack of local funds. As you're aware, the SDC only pays for existing deficiencies. And it's a project that has a pretty high SDC match. So as staff evaluated projects that they thought we could leverage our streets funding for, this project ended up being pretty high on the list because of that opportunity to match those funds.
But SDC funds are your funds too. So it's not really leveraging them, it's just...
Yeah, I guess it's leveraging in the good point. I mean, it's leveraging in the sense that right now we're actually sitting on pretty big balance of system development charge revenues because we don't have the discretionary fund to pay for the non-capacity adding elements of those system development charge projects. And so this would be a way for us to move one of those projects forward.
So I'd like some more information on your system development charges and what you're allowed to do with them. Obviously, I'm familiar with Parks's. We did have a pretty extended discussion of that Flanders thing when we were thinking of putting the Southeast Island Bridge on it.
Definitely.
So, and at that time, we wanted to focus on outer areas, particularly East Portland. So I'm wondering how that $3 million got back up onto the priority list.
Sure, be happy to follow up with you on that. And when I talk about the neighborhood greenway piece, I'll kind of talk a little bit more about some of that balancing on bike projects across the city as well. I think right now in talking to East Portland in Motion, staff that worked on that they feel pretty good about the balance, but it'd be great to follow up on that as we walk through this. So the jumping in, to that next group, it is neighborhood greenway. So
well, I guess that just begs the question is, as part of this process, am I being asked to approve this list? And in which case, are we going to have a public hearing on approving this list? Or what's the process for refining it? We're mostly focusing on the funding mechanism.
Sure.
I want to make sure that there's public input into specifically these projects. And
definitely.
Is that now or is that later?
Well, we were not anticipating putting the specific project lists in the City Council ordinance, partly because in transportation more than in parks, occasionally we discovered that there's other pots of money that are available to do particular projects. So we wouldn't want to bind ourselves to spending X amount of money on Y project and then find out that next year that we can get state money to do the same thing. So we were going to put this out saying this is what we expect to do, and the oversight committee was going to be involved in ensuring that we do what we plan to do, but also in helping make choices between potential projects where there's, you know, where there's a large number of projects competing for a small amount of money.
So the public process is the oversight committee doing the shuffling around of what projects get funded and what don't? I mean, how does the transportation system plan and the city budget play into this?
Sure, let me add a couple pieces. I'm sure you might have a follow-up to that. But when the first part of this project identification process started with using the Needs and Funding Advisory Committee and testing with them a strategy for populating this project list. And our recommendation to that group, which they supported, was to use our existing modal coordinators, pedestrian, bike, freight, safety, to help us, based on existing lists and public feedback, to put an initial project draft list like this together that we are taking through all of our modal committees. That's what we had earlier today was a meeting of those groups to give us some additional feedback on those projects to be included in the first years of the program.
So that's helpful. We're in a new scenario where we're hoping to have a lot more revenue that PBOT has discretion to use than has been in the past, and of a order of magnitude of every year, the amount that I'm going to have, hopefully, if the parks bond measure that I would have for the next 20 years in parks. So I think there needs to be more discussion on the public process every year for deciding PBOT's to-do list. Because, like I said, it's a lot of money, and it seems like the council should have the opportunity, like we do with the Portland Development Commission, to weigh in over this project versus that project. And similarly, there needs to be some balancing between the different modal groups to decide, beyond the commissioner in charge making the choice of how to spend, how much is it, $58 million a year?
Under these scenarios, $40 million a year. There is, Commissioner, something of a chicken and egg question in that people won't support moving forward with a revenue mechanism unless they have some idea